The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I am Stephanie Contours. In the studio with me tonight, Liz Darrow, Michael Vindiola, Dave Willingham, and Tim Johnson. We have a whole bunch of things coming up, but I want to take a quick moment to remind you that we are all volunteers in this studio and at this station. And especially tonight, I just want to remind people that we are here out of the goodness of our hearts, and we leave people behind every week. So a special thank you to our partners tonight, Catherine, Paul, and Michelle, for allowing us to have some time to come and talk about stuff. So thanks, you guys. We, like I said, we have a lot to talk about. Washington State strengthening our own DACA. That just happened. Bellingham tent encampments. That's getting more firm. Hearst and what the heck are loot boxes? If you are young, a gamer, or a parent of one, you will want to know. But first, let's talk about the I-940. If you haven't heard about it, and we just had a conversation about not mentioning bill numbers, but let's just talk about this initiative. And it is really challenging the way that police officers who commit murders or fatal shootings, I should say, whether or not they are prosecutable. I-940 just got the number of signatures to make the ballot, so it is almost certainly going to be on our ballot in November.
Well, this, you know, we talked about this last year during the legislative session, because the year before, back in 2016, there was a statewide commission that came together and put together recommendations on ways to improve and reform some of our laws around policing. And Washington State is the only state in the country where if an officer is involved in a fatal shooting, in order to prosecute that officer for it, the prosecutor would have to prove malice, which means they have to prove what's in the officer's heart. And that has never been done and is probably impossible to do. And so what this initiative would do, among other things, is eliminate that requirement and set up instead standards that can be met to hold our law enforcement agents accountable.
Well, let's back up a bit. What, in a nutshell, what is this initiative and what is it intending to do?
The purpose is to, in broad strokes, kind of reform the way that police at various levels within the state are interacting with their communities and the responsibilities that we what we expect from them and their how we are going to keep them accountable. And in the specifics, it does some things like eliminate the malice requirement. It also encourages some community involvement.
Some of the other stuff it does is requires the police officers to receive violence de-escalation, mental health, and first aid training, and also provide first aid and changes the standards for the use of deadly force. And I think the biggest thing, and the thing that family members and people who are connected with people who have been fatally shot by police in the state have been working on it for a long time. Obviously, being able to prosecute and bring charges to someone without having to prove malice is huge and maybe the underpinning of this whole initiative. However, I think it's very crucial that our police forces do receive mental health training as well, more mental health training than they do now, more first aid training, and hopefully shifts the officer's perspective into aiding more than going after with violence.
Right. I think in the state, well, I have some friends. I have a lot of friends that worked on this campaign. I helped out a little bit. And I think in the state, we really demonstrated the need for de-escalation of our police officers. And so I think we've more than made the case that this is a necessary law. But, you know, just for society in general. But then when you begin to start looking at statistics and who's the who are the folks that are getting killed by the police? That's a whole nother level to begin addressing. So this doesn't fully solve that issue, but it's a beginning place to a necessary step for law enforcement to think of other ways of handling situations. You know, and it's, you know, it's easy to think about, well, there's a situation where this was necessary, but so many cases are, you just scratch your head and wonder why was this used? Why was deadly force used in this situation where somebody called the police and was requesting help, and then they wind up getting shot? You know, how does that all work? So I think that the folks who are putting this bill together are doing, you know, tapping into something important.
Yeah, you know, it strikes me that it's way past time, because the evolution of people becoming police officers has changed too. I mean, that entire paradigm has changed where, you know, and this is ancient history, but when I was a kid, I think people, little kids in school, go, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? It's like, I want to be a firefighter. I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a police officer. I think a lot of those people now are coming out of their military service directly in. I think our military does a poor job of de-escalating people, period. And then they immediately go into law enforcement, and they come into law enforcement from this aspect of, you know, I'm defending against a foreign enemy of some kind. And I think that I don't know about Washington State, because Washington State seems to have dodged some of the horrors that have happened around the country. But almost all the people who have come to the forefront on these cases of police violence, you know, somehow came out of some paramilitary or military background, the militarization of the police, et cetera. So the fact that our police force itself is changing, it seems like we need new systems to address that.
Well, I'm going to push back a tiny bit on that, because we haven't managed to skip out on all of it. The city of Seattle, their police department, is still under a consent decree because they were found by the Justice Department to be...
Oh, what, Dave?
consent decree is the tools that the Justice Department can use to make a deal with a local police agency to say, listen, these are the ways that you're wrong, so we're going to work with you to make things better. And so the city of Seattle was found to be targeting people based on race. They were found to be escalating incidents at a remarkable rate. And they've made some really big strides, but they have a ways to go. And, you know, I make this point every time this comes up. We empower our police with a lot. You know, we're relying on them for a lot, and we need to hold them to a very high standard.
Right.
We keep seeing incidents like the one that always comes into my mind is the officer that shot Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old boy, had been previously fired from a different police outfit because he was not qualified to be an officer.
Right. Right, and there's the tragedies of people actually calling 911 because a family member is out of control and the police show up and kill the family member. Mm-hmm. Say, I didn't call the police to have my family member killed. I called the police because an incident was escalating. I wanted you to de-escalate it, not like take it to the final.
And I think the law that Dave referenced that was on the books, and I can't remember if it was the 80s or 90s when that law was first passed, where you had to prove malice, that law is so problematic in a lot of ways in itself. And so I think this initiative getting on the ballot to begin with is a triumph for the people, because it's looking at the laws that are already in place that that encourage racial profiling and they encourage violence on the part of police officers. And the people took a look at that and said, we're not going to stand for that. And so the signatures that they gathered were well beyond what they needed. And I hope that when people go to vote in the fall, that it'll still be the same overwhelming response, because it's there's a lot going on the books that unnecessary and racially motivated laws that I think we should do away with.
Dave, I have a stupid question for you. Why is this coming to the people as an initiative? How come the legislature could not take action on this?
Well, the legislature did partially take action on this last session, and I think the determination was made that this would be better suited to go to the people, because there were actually some people who were proponents of it that wanted it to go that way. And also, a lot of people didn't think that the legislature was fully willing to go on record about this. And this is, you know, one of those things where it gets kicked to us to make the determination. And frankly, I kind of think this is the right way. I think this is a good reminder for everybody in this state that we determine what our police are going to be. We are not – police are a fact, but the way we interact with them is determined by us. They work for us, and we don't want or need warriors from our police. We have those. We need, you know, people in our community working for the community, and this is a chance for everybody in the state to really think about what kind of cops do we want.
Absolutely. I do want to give a shout out to the organization that has been behind this, and I'm sure, Michael, you have worked with De-Escalate Washington. And De-Escalate Washington is a great organization. You can learn more from them, and you can find them on Twitter and on just the World Wide Web. One of the things that's interesting to me about this, I haven't heard if the state NRA is opposed to it. The only people I've heard so far are police officers, not saying all police officers, not all police officers, but that's the only people I've seen that are speaking out against this. I was involved for a few years with the Community Advisory Council of the Bellingham Police Department. I went through their implicit bias training. And God knows, I'm not going to say that the Bellingham Police Department is perfect or not racist or, you know, that they don't have the same issues. But I certainly saw our police department trying. And that doesn't mean that they can't learn more. I guess my question, maybe this isn't the right group of people to ask this, but the question that I have is, if this is going to help our state police officers be better police officers, why would police officers be against it?
You know, I've managed a lot of different people in a lot of different settings, and nobody likes scrutiny. And one of the things when you're in a high adrenaline, high, you know, responsibility position, getting second guessed makes people defensive. And I think that a lot of it is just based on that. There's a basic, you know, fear of having to explain yourself all the time. And frankly, I think the only way we're going to get rid of that is to train our police officers better and allow those that don't want to be scrutinized to find another career path.
Yeah, I think another issue probably, I mean, just putting my mind in their mind, is the issue of indemnification. When you serve as a public government, you're indemnified against things that happen to a certain extent, so that a firefighter who makes a mistake on a job and the destruction of the fire is greater than it might have been if he hadn't done what he did, he's has a certain indemnification. So I think that there's a fear that that some of that indemnification that you have could be eroded through this.
But let's be clear, though. I mean, speaking of fear, there are a lot of people who are rightfully afraid of the police. And I think they need some days and weeks to go by where they haven't killed anyone, where we're going to feel
zero
at ease.
Days without murder.
Beyond training, you know. Yeah. I mean, seriously, hundreds of people are killed at the hands of police, and most of those are people of color and indigenous people.
Or harassed. I mean, killed and in other ways harassed, or right. Other ways stopped, or otherwise targets of suspicion.
And that's just in Washington State. And so I think whether or not they want more training or scrutiny, I mean, that, like you said, they work for us. And I think even beyond training, it's going to take a lot more than that and just sort of some proof of responsibility that they can interact with the general population. Because right now, a lot of people aren't showing up to places if they know that the police are going to be there. And that's a huge problem as far as everyone's safety is concerned.
Yeah, and Stephanie, you're heading in the direction I was thinking of in terms of responding to what was said about, you know, why would the police not support this? And it is, you know, it is a system. It's a system that is protecting a certain resource or certain values in the society. And I think that that's the main message, is that they don't want to be questioned about what their values are or what their, you know, what system they're protecting. And, you know, I think that's questionable.
Well, our police force changed their motto to committed to community. So hopefully this will be an opportunity to prove that and stand up to that. I would like to invite any police officer or anybody who has an opinion about this issue to weigh in. You can reach us through Facebook, Cascadia News Now on Facebook, or CascadiaNewsNow.com. You can leave a comment there or find our phone number there if you want to. And if you want to come on the show, I would entertain a discussion with some people who have different values about that. Unfortunately, we have so much news to get to that we want to leave that there for now and move on to the Bellingham Sham Tent Encampment Decision. I happen to see Councilman Michael Lilliquist post this, I think, Monday night. Tim, do you want to give us a breakdown?
Well, I can tell you, I spoke to Michael Lilliquist about it last week, and he was on the fence about whether he wanted to introduce it at all. And the reason is that state law already allows churches and charitable organizations to open their properties up to a homeless camp if they want to do it. But the state law has is permissive in certain ways that are difficult for the city, and it's also restrictive in certain areas that are for the city. And I'll give you an example of something that's restrictive. For some reason, the state law says you have to have a fenced area, right? And the city is like, if you don't want to put a fence up and you want to sponsor a homeless camp, that's okay with us. So what the city wanted to do is this law that's enshrined in the state is not permitted through the zoning code of Bellingham at all. So they wanted to acknowledge through the zoning code the state law, and they also wanted to reduce some of the barriers to it. And where the council and where Michael Lilliquist was concerned was he thought that if he put it forward as an emergency ordinance, it might look like they're trying to stop something or they're trying to backfill something, but actually they just wasn't really a good way to introduce this, and so they just chose to put it out there as an emergency ordinance, the effect of which is immediate. And the public comment that occurs is automatic and required under the law. So
that's what we have to look forward to next, is the public comment period.
So I think if I were to put it in a nutshell, I think we can criticize the city for not getting on the ball when winter was bad. But I think what's happened, and I'm not absolutely positive, but I think that some murmuring has occurred from churches and charitable organizations that they'd like to participate in this, and the city is trying to respond to that.
Fantastic, especially if I didn't know that the fence requirement existed. And I do know that places like Garden Street Methodist have an emergency winter shelter. I can only imagine that is nowhere near enough space anymore. We have an average of, I think, 749 homeless people on any given night. So if that's an average, there could be much more than that. And I don't think 749 people can fit in the Garden Street Methodist Church. So if this is another solution that will sort of help maybe not resolve problems, but...
I'm reluctant only because I'm always reluctant, but also...
We like that about you, though.
Also because what I'm hearing from, Jim Peterson, who's been on the show, he's fantastic, and he runs the Homes Now, Not Later, is that he's really displeased with how the city is handling this. And always when it's the voices from the most affected community and they're saying, this isn't going to work for us, then I'd like to see that flexibility piece with the city to say, well, maybe we need to sit down and talk through what are the pieces of this that seem disingenuous to you or just aren't going to work. I mean, maybe it's the religious organization component. I don't know. And I do know there's some restrictions, obviously, because it's city government. But immediately, I heard that Homes Now, Not Later was not pleased and are going to sidestep the city and work with the county. And I think Michael knows more about that.
Yeah, you know what? We had the People's Movement Assembly, and the Homes Now folks were there. And it was not only that they were upset, but that they were not included, not considered, and seems like a organization that represents homeless folks would be considered in a major move like that. And I just have to comment, the Bellingham Herald picked it up and put a big photo of Jim Peterson as if like they asked for a tent city, and here's how the city of Bellingham answered, like it was some kind of collaboration, and that was a really unfortunate move. So yeah, I think that's a crucial step, is that, that community really should be considered and included in that discussion before making a big decision like that. And I think they feel like the timeline, it's going to be another delay thing, and the timeline will just, go on and on. So
yeah, I think that, I mean, my understanding of it from the city standpoint is I don't know that city government was really on board and really tuned into the fact that there was a state law that allowed this to happen until there was the demonstration at City Hall, right, which was a great demonstration and brought a lot of focus and attention. And then suddenly when they realized that there was a state law, attorney went through the state law and it's like, well, it, you know, you have to register people when they show up. It's like, why do you have to register people? And so the attorneys were trying to figure out why the state law allows certain things and restricts certain things, and the city just simply wants, I mean, from my understanding, they want to be permissive to this and to accept this and not create barriers for that. But and it just didn't seem like there was any graceful way to do it, because, you know, as I spoke to council member Lilliquist last week, it could have been, they were afraid that if they introduced it like an emergency ordinance, it would appear that they were trying to stop something, or they were trying to follow up the fast one, or they were trying to get around something. The other process would have taken weeks through to introduce it through new business and then to bring it in committee, and that would take probably about a month and a half.
Well, just in the context, you know, earlier this week there was the census in King County, and now in the King County area there are almost 30,000 homeless people, and I'm glad that the city is doing something. I think that at least acknowledging that the process is moving, I think that they have a lot of work to do. And you're right, the constraints of the bizarre state law issue is one that I think is going to keep coming up. But I was glad to see at least some acknowledgement that they're trying to do something.
Right. And I think that there's a long way to go, because, I mean, the other thing that came out talking to city council people last week was, you know, they're still trying to work with the county to find a place for a long-term shelter. And the county's position is, well, what are you going to pay us for that? And the city's like, why should we have to pay anything for that? Because this homelessness is a county-wide issue, and you need to be partners with us. Why should we pay the county money for a piece of property the county owns? Why? So there is this sort of high-level and largely invisible conversation going on between the city and the county about roles and responsibility as well.
And I think that's exactly the problem, unfortunately, is that transparency and inclusivity and responsiveness do not seem to be the city council's strong suits. And so as a community member on the outside of homelessness, I can't say what people who are homeless might need the most. And so I think just bringing folks into the conversation, even if every need can't be met, would go a long way. And as a person who does send several emails to the council members, I know that they're not always great about getting back. So I think that, I mean, not to just critique it to death, but I think that when affected people feel left out, then that gives this feeling of, you know, the government versus the people. And I don't think that that's helping the city council or the homeless people.
Well, as Tim referred to, the week-long protest on the grounds of City Hall was an excellent opportunity, not just a photo opportunity, but, I mean, literally in the face of council members who then had to address this issue. And maybe that's why there was some movement, maybe even if the movement wasn't the best or inclusive enough, that there was some movement at all. Michael, you also referenced that Homes Now was at the People's Movement Assembly this past weekend, and I would really love for both of you to give us sort of an overview of how powerful that was.
Yeah, that was a very awesome opportunity for Homes Now to join in, and there was it wasn't on the original agenda, but it was, since it was a pressing issue, the decision was made to add them as a topic for a discussion at the People's Movement Assembly, and then what came from that was they had donations that were, they were holding an event that same day. And so the People's Movement Assembly was kind of crossing over that event. So then they had a large cold weather clothing giveaway that was happening the same day. So then we wound up collaborating, and the event was held at the Bellingham High School. And it, you know, it was two major events happening, and it was great energy and just being able to share the same space just created an awesome dynamic, you know, for communities that don't necessarily come together that often. And that was the whole purpose of the People's Movement Assembly, was to address a wide range of topics, issues that are happening in the community, in the, you know, Bellingham, Whatcom County community, and, you know, to generate dialogues and to generate support for each other's issues and movements. So that was a great outcome of that collaboration.
Yeah, and that's what I love about the People's Movement Assembly. I've been to a few in the past, and it seems like the goal has always been to bring different efforts together and strengthen movements through collaboration and cooperation and dialoguing about, you know, what are the issues that are happening. And so I also love that it starts out with the, what's the Brazilian Drumming Brigade?
Oh, yeah, that was, we started out with what's called a Mystica, which is just kind of opening the space and beginning with a you know, just high energy, and we were successfully able to bring, oh, what is their name? Now I'm going to forget. I think it's Batuchada Northwest.
Fantastic.
And, yeah, and they were in our climate march last year in May. And so we were hunting high and low for them, their contact. We finally found them, and then it was a last-minute addition. They let us in this very ceremonial and celebratory entrance to begin the day. And it really just drew folks together. And following that, we had each of the organizations that was represented there to lead us in chants or, you know, stories or, you know, whatever they wanted to share. And so it really brought to, you know, just opened with a real collaborative effort to, you know, come together and just try to understand a little bit about each other.
So. And what were some of the other constituencies that were at the People's Movement Assembly?
Oh my gosh, you're really gonna.
We have a Racial Justice Coalition. The Red Lion Salish Sea was there. Organizers of the Women's March were there. The Riveters Collective, the Birchwood Food Desert Fighters. Union guys, I always forget their name. The Wobblies were there, and Indivisible Washington was there. So it's this huge.
And Skagit. There's three chapters of Indivisible. Yeah.
And I think starting out in the way of celebration that Michael described isn't something that we're used to necessarily here in Bellingham. But I know that Edgar Franks has traveled and and done some people's movements elsewhere around the world. And it turns out that if you start out with drums and dancing and chanting and that kind of just really upbeat. Energy, then when you get down to the work, which is can be pretty serious in terms of homelessness and racism and all the things trying to tackle, people tend to have this, at least come into it with some gusto in it. And then, and I know Michael likes to do a cumbia break there toward the end too, which I miss this time.
A what?
Cumbia is a Latin dance. It feels to me like salsa because I'm not a dancer, but it's different and I know that. But just the idea of, you know, take a break, dance with someone you don't know very well, you know, just all throughout celebration, but also the meat of it really was, you know, who are these groups, what's the work they're doing, and how can we collaborate to move forward as a community together. So it was cool.
I was super bummed to have missed it. I know there will be more. If you also missed it, we have a list of events that you can get in touch with on our Facebook page, Cascadia News Now at Facebook, and I will read those at the end of the show as well. I'm going to take the last couple minutes in this first half hour to give you an update on Maru Mora Villalpando. If you heard us last week, you know that Immigration's Customs Enforcement, or ICE, deportation threat on her, and it is gaining national attention. Maru Villalpando has been featured in the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Washington Post. She was interviewed on Democracy Now!, which is also on our Facebook page. The Stranger reported that all 9 Seattle City Council members signed a statement saying that they are angered by the ICE deportation notice. Our Washington Congresswoman representing that area, Pramila Jayapal, called the action, quote, nothing but an attempt to drive fear into immigrant communities, intimidate people out of standing up for their rights, and weaken our movement for change.
Absolutely. I was just reading Adam Smith on Twitter earlier, and he's the Washington's 9th district representative. So that includes Tacoma, and he gave a personal thank you to Maru for the work that she's doing. And it's just such a great example of how elected representatives can connect with folks just in a real human way. But from my perspective, the work continues, and I know that if people want to help, there was a fundraiser up at Western today from the Blue Group to help Maru with her legal funds that are probably going to continue. This is a long, drawn-out process, right? And people can also donate at the Northwest Detention Center Resistance online. You can find that on Facebook. And there's an action February 4th, next Sunday, which is It's a tribunal of the Northwest Detention Center. So the idea is to call into question the way that they do the things that they do. So that is next Sunday down in Tacoma, and you can find that on Facebook as well.
Yeah, that's on one of the links that we have, and we'll talk about that more later.
And we also have the petition in support of her work, and so we want to make sure that we let folks know about that as
Okay.
well.
Yes, and that is on Facebook as well. You are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt, and we will be right back after this.
KMRE is your community voice. For over a decade, we brought you volunteer-powered, locally produced radio programming. As one of the few nonprofit radio stations in Bellingham, we bring quality broadcasting, diverse voices, and compelling ideas to the airwaves. Programming you'll not hear anywhere else. We need your help. KMRE needs a new home. Help us save our broadcast license and become fully independent. If local media is important to you, now is the time to keep KMRE alive. Please visit savekmre.org to donate now. Again, please go to savekmre.org and keep community radio strong. Thank you.
You are tuned to Cascadia News Now on KMRE, and it is time for the Ledge portion of the show. Wah Ledge, that is, so much happening in the LEG. Let's get started with the State Senate and the movement that they took to help shore up DACA. And we are one of the top 10 states for the number of DACA students in our state, over 17,000 students. So Dave, do you want to give us an update?
Sure. So this has been an effort that's been in process for a while. And what the legislature I think the Senate passed it today. Mm-hmm. They guarantees state student funding availability for students regardless of immigration status. And this has been something that we've sort of had from time to time, and I think this is a more permanent version.
Well, one of the things that we already had was that DACA students could pay the same state-level tuitions, and I think that this expands this in order to give students opportunity. They can't necessarily qualify for federal scholarships, but we can shore them up with state scholarships.
Well, maybe let's take a step back for our listeners and explain what DACA is.
So DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and the people that are affected by this, if you haven't been paying attention to local news, it may sound familiar in terms of a national government shutdown, because that is definitely the tie-in. And this is about children who are here from a very early age and are not documented, but they have been raised in our country, and they want to go to school, and they want to be educated, and they want to give back to their country. And so this has sort of been a gray area, depending on the administration in the past, and our current federal administration is cracking a really, really harsh and unfortunate whip in terms of all immigrants, let's be clear, all immigrants, and it's horrifically unfair what's happening, but particularly for these kids who are just trying to go to school.
Yeah, these are what we have called the Dreamers, and I don't think there is a gray area, because the Dreamers are that group of people. They're children who came to the country under no volition of their own. They were brought here by their parents for whatever reason. There's
Let me
requirements.
Clarify. I said there's been a federal administrative.
I understand that, but yeah. I wanted to just back up, because I don't think there is a gray area, because this is the one class of people where everybody said these people are great. They're going to school. They're young professionals. Their condition is not of any fault of their own. And in order to remain in the program, you have to have an absolutely clean criminal record. You have to be an upstanding citizen. So, you know, when people on the right talk about what they don't like about immigration, this is the thing that they say is great, because these are like the people we want, right? So now, I don't think there is a gray area, but suddenly there is a gray area, because President Trump, by executive order, eliminated the DACA program, and he threw it to Congress, and he made something that had been depoliticized political. And so he created a crisis, and now I think every state has to adjudicate this crisis in their own way. Washington State's already been pretty clear about how it's going to deal with immigration issues in the future. And I think that our new Senate in Olympia are chomping at the bit to erect some constructs in state law that give the people that live in the state some protections against federal excess.
Well, absolutely. And I will push back a little bit because maybe in prior administrations, this was a no-brainer. But now, yes, it is our federal administration, but there are people who are jumping on that bandwagon. Unfortunately, there are people who are kind of, I'm just going to go out on a limb, they're buying the hype. And so it's becoming this lump of we don't want illegals. And it's horrific, particularly when Jay Inslee just was recently talking, as we've talked about on a different show, and he went up against our own Department of Licensing, who had gone up against him. And he had said, no, we're not going to give anything beyond what is absolutely required to the government. Turns out the Department of Licensing had been. Mm-hmm. And the pushback on our governor was incredible from Washingtonians. Not all Washingtonians, but the Washingtonians who are anti-immigrant are suddenly anti-all-immigrant, and there are a lot of people who are lumping everybody together.
There's a lot of people who want to have a war over this, and they're working very hard to make it happen. You know, we saw the if you were on social media at all over this weekend, you probably saw the bus in Florida where immigration officials were demanding papers from people on a bus, and you don't need papers to ride a bus. And the federal agents are prosecuting people who live near the southern border who are providing aid and comfort to people who might not be documented. And you know, I think it's very important that our state is stepping up and saying that that's disgusting. We are not participating in that. I wish very, very much that they could do more because, you know, especially, and as you were talking about, Tim, we made a deal with people under DACA.
Yes.
You know, it was very restrictive, very harsh lines. You had to be born after a certain date, before a certain date. You had to be in school, in a job, and you had to pay every year to apply. And you know, we made a deal where if you go through this process and you follow these rules, we will, you know, allow you to stay in this country and work and live like the American you are. And now in order to provoke this war, in order to satisfy the worst elements of our society, we are betraying those people.
Right. And I think that one thing that is probably doesn't get enough play is the idea that out of the entire class of immigrants, documented, undocumented, legal, illegal, whatever, however you want to describe them, the president's order that he signed about DACA puts these people to the very front of the line for deportation. So a group of people that weren't even being considered for deportation by the president's order now are the first to get out of the country. And these are people who honestly, truly, think about this. They have no country other than this country. This is the only country they've ever lived in, the only country they've ever known. They were brought here as children. It's unimaginably cruel that this situation has arisen, and only cruel minds would pressure this.
Yeah, I agree with you on the cruelty of it. And one of the things that, and certainly we just got done talking about Maru and the work that she's doing and some of the issues that she's facing. And one of the things that we always have to consider or think about when we're looking at, well, who's the worst and who's the best and who's okay to keep in the country and who's not okay. And you know, I think, you know, Maru and many of us would say, you know, no one is illegal. And to do this division, it just creates further chaos and more division, which is so unhealthy. But you know, I think when we're discussing these policies, I mean, like if you just look at Maru is somebody who's been here for many years, not been in any legal trouble, and ICE comes out and you know, wants her to report. And why do they want her to report? Because of what reason?
She was a leader.
And she's the leader. She's organizing and she's defending immigrant rights. And so, you know, that's really frustrating and complicated because all of these, you know, whatever front. So essentially it means whatever front you're on, you're a target. And you know, they could be coming after you. So.
Well, and then let me help you complicate that even more. I mean, one of the things that I think is so powerful about Maru Moron-Villalpando is, yes, she's a leader for immigrant issues. She's also the leader of the Northwest Detention Center resistance, and the Northwest Detention Center is a private prison, mm-hmm. and it's owned by GEO. And I'll go out on a limb and say, there is money behind this.
Right.
It's not just she's a fly in the ointment. It's not that she's just annoying people. It's that she is going up against big prison, the big prison industry.
Yeah, what is it I constantly say on the show? The nail that sticks up gets pounded flat.
Mm. Well, let's hope not.
Yes, right. But I mean, that's the kind of the mentality of this administration is that the leaders of diverse opinion that don't necessarily fall in line, they're the ones that are going to get hammered flat.
Yeah, and we see that, you know, in our here in Whatcom County, Bellingham, you know, collaboration with the Justice Department and setting up warrants, you know, and that goes back to, you know, organizations that I'm affiliated with Red Line Sailor Sea, you know, their Facebook, our Facebook group was, you know, a warrant was put on them and it was failed two times, but through the collaboration between the county or the prosecutor.
State and the county.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Prosecutor with the Department of Justice, would it, you know, and then Erickson's, you know, economic terrorism law, you know, it's movements to chill or quiet dissension from the people, you know, being able to speak out against the unfair and unjust policy and business and how that all fits together.
So. Right. And it's one of, you know, as I like to say, it's one of the rights that are is enshrined in the Constitution. It actually comes before the right to bear arms, the right to express oneself, the one to gather and ask for redress of government. That is an enshrined right. And it's a shame that it's not more universally cherished in our society.
Getting back to our state Senate passing this initiative on to the House, our own Kevin Ranker, who says over and over again that we are building a blue wall brick by brick. He said it is our moral obligation to make sure that every child, no matter who you are or what country you came from, has access to college, meaningful careers, and full lives. And one of the prime sponsors of this bill, Senator Rebecca Saldana, said, we would love for the federal government to act, but they haven't. Mm-hmm. But we can act to expand opportunities for dreamers. So we will watch that as it moves to the House with our fingers crossed. Meanwhile, there's so much more ledge action, and I don't want to neglect Hearst, one of my favorite topics, but there's been a lot of movement in water wells this week. Who wants to take that?
Well, I might jump in quickly on it and say that, you know, there's a lot of sunshine that's being shown in Olympia, but whenever the sun shines, there's shadows thrown, and I think Hearst is one of these examples. I think what happened here is that the issue of rural wells was going to become a thorny and difficult issue for the Democrats. They couldn't move forward and get their capital budget approved. They couldn't move forward on the things that we're talking about, DACA, all the other things that they have, with this thing lying out there. And they did not want the reverse of that, which is being beaten up all year long on the fact that they didn't care about the rights and, or I don't even want to call them rights, but the issues of rural property owners and rural homeowners. They were indifferent to those. So I think they wanted to very quickly move past this. And I think that what they did was they passed a, I think it was a bad law. I think it's got a lot of critics, but it allowed them to come together with the Republicans, get something out there that allowed them to move fast and quickly, and now they're into their legislative session beyond Hearst.
Yeah, you're right to not say rights. In under Western water law, you don't have a right to water.
Correct.
If you just buy a plot of land.
Correct.
And I think that that's something that a lot of people will not or cannot internalize. This is not a great solution, and I think anyone who's been paying attention to this knows this is the prelude for a lawsuit.
Yeah.
You know, this is now, instead of kicking it down the road by doing nothing or actually addressing the problem of water in Washington state, they've decided to kick it to the state Supreme Court, which is going to put us in just another McCleary thing, which means we're going to still be hearing about this for another 15 years.
Right. But not only that, but it invites a lawsuit from people that actually probably have some standing in law. I mean, the opposite side, if nobody took action on this, the rural well owners, they don't have any rights under the law. They don't have a water right. So, but what they've done now is they've sort of favored those groups over the people that actually have water rights, such as the tribes and municipalities, et cetera. And those municipalities, the tribe, they have rights. They have a water right. They have standing in the court. So I don't think they help themselves. And just to give a little background on what this is, Whatcom County is at the very center of this issue because in 2016, the Supreme Court said that Whatcom County was not properly planning its growth for in areas of adequate water supply. And within that decision, it said that ecology is not the determining force in this. It's county planning that's the determining force. That threw everybody in the state into a big turmoil because they would like ecology to be a partner in their decision. If ecology is going to set the rules, then they would like ecology to also be police the rules and also be kind of on the hook for the rules as well. So that, I think that was a legitimate concern for all of the counties and everybody involved, is that somehow this fix that we keep talking about, this legislative fix, needed to clarify ecology's role. But what it really did was it just said business as usual, and whatever you guys are doing, you can just keep doing. And oh, by the way, we'll throw some money at it and hope that things work out okay. That's pretty much what they decided to do last week.
Yeah, and I think it's important to mention there are some things in there. There's, if you live within certain watersheds, you have to pay a fee to drill a well, and depending on where you are, there are limits on how much water you can take out. Here in the Nooksack watershed, it's 3,000 gallons per day. It does explicitly kick responsibility of this all to the Department of Ecology. If I worked at ecology, I would be very unhappy.
Well, I would be too. The other thing is, and I think this is very illuminating, and this really jumped out at me. I believe it's Yakima and Clallam County and Skagit County are all exempt from this particular bill. Why? Because they're already at work on their water resource plans. Mm. And this is where Whatcom County should have been for the last 2 years. I do not understand why Whatcom County government did not get to work on coming up with a plan. Had they done so, they would also be exempt from this in the sense of its application. I mean, you know, not in terms of resources applied, but I just don't understand why they were dragging their heels. They're the ones that set off this bomb.
Now, is this a done deal, or does it still have movement?
This is signed law. It was signed by the governor, and so it, when it takes effect, will be the law of the land here in Washington State. I really don't think it's going to survive in its current form for a very long time. I think that a lot of municipalities, you know, in coming years, if not sooner, will have some issue with the rate of approval. I think a lot of people are going to be like, oh boy, now we get to do this. And it is going to have an effect in some watersheds. I think that various treaty tribes in the state are going to have a strong case both in state and potentially federal court that this is not acceptable under the treaties that we have, which are the supreme law of the land.
And I'm not sure it's going to stand up on a review by the state Supreme Court either, because essentially, and I've made this point before about Hearst, but essentially what the legislature is saying is that things that the court identified as problems, legislature saying, no problem. But I think that the Supreme Court is going to say, you know, the things that we said were problems, they continue to be problems. Whether the legislature wants to say that they're problems or not, they continue to be issues. And those issues are there's not enough water in the streams for fish.
Yeah, I hate to even chime in on this as a tribal person, and because I don't want to say the wrong thing and misrepresent.
How about as a water protector?
I'm here for that for sure. And I guess I would say that, you know, just the frustrating, you know, we talked about the Constitution. You mentioned treaties being the supreme law of the land. And, you know, it's really frustrating to just, you know, it's so convenient to just attack when convenient. And it just is, you know, I'm thinking of a couple elders who came to our we were having a tribal sovereignty curriculum training at Lummi Nation School, and it just so happened the school had some elders that were visiting, and they came in and talked about their experience with tribal law and tribal defending their treaties. And one of the elders just said, you know, when I started this work, I was, you know, 20 years old. At that time, I was running around the state, playing in basketball tournaments, having the time of my life. And then my elders said, you have to come home and start fighting for defending these treaties. And then he said, and that's been my life. And he's an elder now. And you could just hear the frustration. And he said, I never wanted to do this. I never wanted, you know, this is not what I wanted to do with my life. But this is what we've been set up to do. This isn't our cultural ways. This is what we've been trained to do in response to always having our treaty rights challenged and having to defend them. And so now we're experts at it, and we're really good at it. And I think that was just such a, you know, I just feel frustrated whenever I think about that in cases like this that come forward. And it's just like, you know, any opportunity to try to pick away and diminish, and there's more case law on it, so that gets cited for, you know, just picking away at treaty rights. And so that's really frustrating. And I always just, to calm myself down, I kick back to being a water protector and acknowledging that Coast Salish people will always be caretakers of this land, no matter, you know, what is going on here. And so that gives me a little bit more solace to just say, you know, we'll always be defenders of you know, the health of the ones that can't speak, you know, that can't speak up, which is water and land and the fish. And so
we owe you a great debt, you and fellow water protectors, for being put in that position, unfortunately. I'll let you have the last word on that and move on to loot boxes, which is a term many of us may not have heard before. Dave, what is a loot box, and why does Senator Ranker care about it?
Okay, I promise to make this less than an hour. So in, you know, the history of video games, especially multiplayer video games, it started out fairly early on when we got to EverQuest around the turn of the 20th century. People played that game and played that game and played that game and put hundreds and thousands of hours into it, and some people didn't want to do that. They just wanted to spend money to buy stuff that other people had. So a side business started up with people buying and selling accounts on eBay and other services. People were paying thousands of dollars for imaginary accounts, and the game publishing industry said, oh, people will pay for more stuff after they buy the game. So they started putting in microtransactions in the game. You want a hat that looks a certain way, you pay this much. You want a sword that's a little better, you pay this much. And that market kind of went on. There's the whole, if you have a mobile phone, you know what I'm talking about. That, you know, with the alternative currencies, the just one more turn, you know.
Something's crush.
Right. Farmville at one point was making $1 billion a year because people were buying things at, you know, just a couple dollars here and there, and some people were paying a lot. And so that kind of became the direction the video game market was going, and it was free games where you get gouged on everything. And that started to change a little bit recently. You know, these free games started to experiment with some other models, and one of the more popular ones that came out of Japan in China and Japan before it was banned in Japan was instead of paying for an item, instead of paying for that hat, instead of paying for that sword, you bought a key to open a box, and everything in the game, every monster you killed, every time you turned around, you found a box, but you had to buy the key. And that box had a chance of having what you wanted, and it also had a chance of having a whole bunch of other stuff. And so that really, really infested the multiplayer free gaming market. And just last year, they may have killed the golden goose because they started introducing that to $60 full price games where you buy the game, maybe you buy the collector's edition, which is $100, and then you have the opportunity to buy boxes that might have more things in them to make you look better, to make you fight better, to do all these things. And that has started to put those companies in the crosshairs of governments around the world. Belgium is investigating, and what Senator Ranker is, and a couple of other senators are asking, is that the State Gambling Commission investigate this practice, which is clearly gambling, and come up with some recommendations. And this isn't the first time they've done this. They've gone after gambling around video games. There was a very popular video game called Counter-Strike that you could win different colored guns and things like that in the game, and then people would set them up in third-party casinos, and you could buy a chance at that. And the state shut that down a couple of years ago, and so I think they're taking another stab at it.
Well, I don't mean for this question to sound as cynical as it might sound, but this is revenue that the state has no access to, right? I mean, this is not a taxable issue for the state.
Nope.
And so there's, not only is there potential consumer fraud, but there's also an issue of lots of financial transactions going around to the state that the state does not benefit from.
That they don't pay taxes on. And I think that's an excellent point. And then the other thing, I will just tell you a quick story. If you're listening to this going, why should I care? I don't play Candy Cow or Farmer Crush or any of that. If you have children, they may, and when you download something on your phone that says in-app purchases, you may not get your parents' permission or may be connected to a credit card. And so there's a whole other issue of minors spending and getting hooked who may not realize all of the implications of this. So
I think there's a whole issue, and we talked about this before the show with our lovely producer, our awesome producer. There's a issue with parenting and just being in control and how we are really minding our children. I guess that makes me old school or something. I don't know. But it just, it really plays into that. You know, and we just see so many kids that are babysat by iPads and electronic devices, and they make it so easy to do
right.
that, you know, to hand over your commerce.
And absolutely. And I'm so sorry to cut you off, but it is time to go. And we will definitely talk about this more, maybe even more than you want us to, in future episodes. But this has been Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contours, and our guest tonight, Liz Darrow, and you just heard from Michael Vindiola, Dave Willingham, and Tim Johnson. Thank you both so much. And our fabulous engineer, Devlin Sweeney. And it's produced by me, and technical director is Dave Willingham. Very quickly, and this is on our Facebook page, I wanted to say tomorrow, if you're listening to us live, Thursday, January 25th, 7 p.m., Planning Commission, ADUs, you'll want to know about it. We'll talk about it next week. Sunday, January 28th, Rapid Response Training for Deportation Defense at the First Congregational Church. That's also on our website. Know Your Rights Training for People Interested in Rapid Response. And then Sunday, February 4th in Tacoma, the People's Tribunal. This is Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.